Good morning. I'm very excited and honored to introduce the next speaker, a young friend of mine. On a personal note, my daughter-in-law's Chavruta in Israel, teacher of my granddaughters for their bat mitzvah preparations. So we really go back a long time, and it's a very special zechut to introduce Rebbe Shani Tarrigan. Shani Tarrigan completed a B.A. and M.A. in Tanakh and Talmud at Bar Ilan University. She's currently pursuing her Ph.D. in Tanakh while serving as a Ram at Midreshet Lindenbaum. She also teaches collegiates and adults at Matan, Migdal Oz, Sha'alvin for Women, and the Women's Beit Midrash in Efrat, and brings Tanakh to life as she leads Tanakh Tehillim throughout the country. Shani is a graduate of Nishmat's Karen Ariel program for certification as a halachic advisor in issues of family purity law. She lectures throughout Israel and serves on the local religious council dealing with issues of Jewish law and education. Shani lives with her husband and six children. She does all that with her husband and six children in Alon Shvut, Gush Etzion. Welcome, Rebbe Tarrigan.
Thank you for the pleasure and privilege of learning Torah with you this morning, and particularly focusing on different skills and education and means through which we can inspire and educate our children. So this morning, for those who are wondering, based on the topic, we're going to be speaking about the role of mashal, the role of a parable or metaphor, not merely in Tanakh, as we see from various stories and mishalim of Nevi'im, but rather in education, and through which we're going to extrapolate from the stories in Tanakh and try to employ in modern methods of education. So firstly, with regard to a parable, Webster's Dictionary defines a parable as a short, simple story from which a moral lesson may be drawn by means of comparison. However, contrary to other anecdotes and illustrations, instead of being intended to merely illustrate or amuse, the parable is intended really to surprise and reveal. And my psychologist brother, Dr. Yomi Feiner, pointed out this morning, he sent me an article and by Sam Levins, who defines a metaphor and other rhetorical devices as those that may sweeten the experience of speech and writing, but give rise to multiple interpretations, ambiguity, and vagueness in a way in which we challenge the creative mind. And this perhaps is the secret of the metaphor, of the mashal, not only to deliver a message, but to enable one to think about the message, not only to sweeten it, but ultimately to challenge one to see how to apply it to his or her life. The narrative begins in the setting of the familiar, the surprise of the unfamiliar, disrupting the listeners in their expectations or in their perception of reality. And this allows the parable to increase the force of its impact. The fact that the parable often adapts the light tone of a tale does not mean that this genre is less serious than other biblical genres, nor that we can take its lessons less seriously. In fact, it is precisely because the subjects of the parables are so important and deep that they move us, that they effectively transmitted in this way, force us to think about what we generally call the nimshal, the lesson that is meant to be learned. Whether it's Rav Nachman Mibreslov who incorporates this educational technique as he retells stories, some of which seem really like folk tales that are meant to bring messages to life. And with this then, we're going to start with a more modern era, starting with the famous story of the Princess and the Pea, a story that I think we're all very familiar with from Hans Christian Andersen, one that was initially published for the first time in 1835. Anderson, who had heard some version of the story as a child and likely used it as the basis in his folk material and in order to share this oral tradition. The story tells, as we all know, of a prince who wants to marry a princess but is having difficulty finding a suitable wife. Something is always wrong with the person whom he meets, and it cannot be certain that they are a real princess because they have bad table manners, or they are too fat or thin or not beautiful. One stormy night, a young woman drenched with rain seeks shelter in the prince's castle. She claims to be a princess, so the princess's mother decides to test their unexpected unwitting guest by placing a pea in a bed she has offered for the night, covered by 20 mattresses and 20 feather beds. Only for the next morning, the mother asks this young woman, "How did you sleep?" And the young woman replies, "Terribly. I tossed and turned all night. My back is so sore." To which the prince's mother responded in a very excited manner, "Now we know that you are a true-blooded princess by virtue of the fact that you felt the pea underneath the bed." And then they went off to live happily ever after. And in one version of the story, we even find that the concluding sentences and the pea can be found in a museum till today. The nimshal of the story, however, is quite complicated. Anyone here ever learn what the message of the story is? What values was Anderson trying to impart to the readers? Is this merely to entertain? So any possibilities of thought? What did we always learn? What is the message of the princess and the pea? Sensitivity, in a positive way? So that certainly is how most literary scholars understand the nimshal of the story. They observe that Anderson blended his childhood memories of a primitive world in which his social climber's private romance with the serene, secure, and cultivated Danish bourgeoisie did not quite accept him as their own. And Anderson felt to a certain degree that he, like the princess, coming in drenched into the palace, does not belong. But it's really in one's blood. There's a certain sensitivity. Anderson wanted to show that the sensitive princess, that those who are indeed due royalty, can feel a pea through 20 mattresses, that no nobility is derived from an individual's birth, but rather from sensitivity. Sensitivity here to the pea, perhaps serving as a metaphor for her depth of feeling and compassion. And this is what he wants to say true malchut, in fact, is. True royalty, the ascent to the monarchy, is dependent on one feeling a pea. It's dependent on one having that sensitivity even to something that appears to be quite simple and menial in one's life. But we don't necessarily have to turn to Hans Christian Andersen or even contemporary tales, because long before all of this, Lahavdil ben Kodesh Lachol, the prophets, the Nevi'im, employed various creative devices. They're the ones who employed the Mashal. And although we find within the Torah itself, for example, coming up in a few weeks, the famous brachot of Bil'am, Vayisa Mishalo Vayomar, it's not merely beautiful words of poetry, but metaphors that Bil'am employs in order to engender a certain level of beauty, whether it's Matovu o Halacha Yaakov Mishkanotecha Yisrael, the Chazal are then going to derive, are going to understand and infer from the Mishalim all different aspects of society, of married life, of tzniut, of beauty that is portrayed through this Mashal of Bil'am. Throughout, certainly, the poetic statements of the Torah, of Nevi'im and Ketuvim, we see this all the more. Perhaps the master, though, of Mishalim, as stated very explicitly by the Tanakh itself, is none other than Shlomo HaMelech, not merely because he composed the very famous Mishlei, a composition of various Mishalim, but because we know that the Navi himself in Sefer Melachim tells us about the Mishalim of Shlomo HaMelech, the words of wisdom, and even more than words of wisdom, the parables, the metaphors that he employed. Metaphors, we learn, should be consistent with the development of the person that is being spoken to. Metaphors should be drawn from the everyday world of common sense. Metaphors should evoke a rich sensory response, not only to our intellect, but some type of emotional response as well. The mashal will always contain patterns of events and general relationships that are in tune with the client's situation and are likely then to be cued in. And perhaps most importantly, metaphors have multiple interpretations. So if the subject's problems are many, if they are diffuse, then perhaps the client himself, the subject, will understand the various mishalim in a different way and maybe even in a different time. And therefore, most literary and, to a certain degree, psychological understandings of metaphors point to three basic factors in what a mashal is. And those are the factors of memory, comprehension, but most importantly, the emotional and behavioral impact. And Chazal don't spare any words as they try to understand the famous pasuk that we find not only said in Kohelet Perek Yud Bet, of Kohelet, namely Shlomo being a chacham, tikein mishalot harbei. Chazal understands in the Midrash and Shir HaShirim, which we also understand as a mashal, as a metaphor, that Shlomo employed the mashal, both in Kohelet and in Shir HaShirim, and throughout Sefer Mishlei in various techniques, whether it's, as we see, in different metaphorical descriptions of Shlomo's mishalim. One statement of Chazal is that Shlomo sought out the words of Torah and employed a mashal to basically give what are known as yadiot, to provide handles for the Torah. Shlomo understood, as we should understand, as parents and educators, that sometimes speaking directly to a child isn't necessarily going to, certainly not inspire the child, but perhaps is not always the most effective mechanism through which we can teach the child. Sometimes we have to garnish the Torah with various spices or provide handles, something that the child, the student, can literally hold on to and understand how this is relevant to his or her life. Another interesting mashal that Chazal tell us, based on the mishalim of Shlomo, is that Shlomo was trying to offer a mashal as a coil of string, as if a wise man had left string in order to help people navigate through a labyrinth of a palace, to tell us that a mashal is sometimes also the guiding light, the beacon through which we can better understand the story. Or maybe, Chazal tell us, a mashal is more like a sickle that is used to enable one to weave through an entire place or a thicket of reeds. Or maybe it's really a handle of a basket of fruit. And this is all based on Shir HaShirim Rabbah, wherein Chazal tried to explain what is this genre of mashal, what is a parable, why are metaphors used? They're used to beautify, they're used to help us remember, but they're also used in order to help us appreciate the message of behavior. Maybe they're also handles for a jug of boiling water, telling us that Torah is like that boiling water, which at times is a little too hot to touch right now, but the means through which we can somehow gain some insight into the words of Torah is through the mashal. Or perhaps a chain of ropes tied together in order to draw water from a deep well. The mashal also helps us understand, will help us bring that water from the well. Or maybe even a mashal is like a cheap wick used to find precious jewels in the darkness. The mashal elucidates what the basic message is in order to clarify the messages that we're supposed to incorporate in our lives and the creative means. So we're going to turn, as you see, to the prophets, to famous mishalim, and perhaps the famous of them all. Even before Shlomo HaMelech, Natan HaNavi, the primary prophet, who serves as the prophet of the king, the Navi HaMelech, during the time of the Davidic dynasty, he's going to employ a very famous mashal. The mashal after the sin of David and Bathsheba, which very often is misunderstood as a sin of Giloy Arayot, and yet we see more from the mashal that Natan berates David, not necessarily for the way that he treated Bathsheba exclusively, but rather for how he sent a message to Yoav thereafter to cover up his sin by placing Uriah, the husband of Bathsheba, in the front lines of the rebellion against Rabbat B'nai Ammon, and thereby to ensure the death of Uriah, hoping that no one will know of his sin. So it's not so much a sin of promiscuity, and as much as a sin of murder. In the wake of this, Natan approaches David, and this is the Perek and Shmuel Bet, Perek Yud Bet, that we're going to examine right now. The parable, the Mashal, a very powerful genre to surprise and elicit a deeper understanding. From Natan and from many Nevi'im, we as educators are going to learn how not only in a creative way to offer musar, to offer some level of rebuke and lessons to the subjects, to our students, to our children, but also to appreciate how we can elicit a response from them. So with this, we're going to take a look at the Mashal and try to understand not only the technique, but also the very creative devices that are applied and employed from this very famous Perek of Tanakh. We begin with the exposition of the Perek, Vayishlach Hashem et Natan el David. Just to remind you, from the previous chapter, Perek Yud Aleph in Sefer Shmuel Bet told us how David is going to be the one to send for Bathsheba, to send for Uriah, to send Uriah off, to send a message to Yoav. The milah mancha, the excessive use of shlichim, of various agents in the previous chapter, gave David, offer him an exaggerated sense of power. With that exact same verb, Hashem sends Natan, almost as if the Navi wants to tell us, let's see who really has the power. Let's see who's in control. Midah keneged midah, the reproach and punishment for David is going to open up with the same word, Vayishlach. Vayishlach Hashem et Natan al David vayavo elav, vayomer lo. And we're waiting for words of Musar. Shame on you. And David, how could you have sent someone to his death just to cover up what you had done with his wife? But instead, Natan opens up with a story. Shnei anashim hayu b'ir achat, achad ashir ve'achad rosh. There were two men in one city, one who was rich and the other one who was poor. La ashir hayat son uvakar harbe ma'od. The rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds. V'larash in kol ki im kivsa achat tana asher kana. But the poor man had nothing, all but a very little lamb, which he had bought and reared, and it grew up with him, v'yichayeha, v'tigdal imo v'imbanav yachtav, and he raised it with his own children, giving us a sense that he raised the lamb almost like Mary, as a child of his own. Mipito tochal, umikoso tishteh, and very descriptive terms that we find. He ate with him, and he drank of his own cup. He lay together with him. Uvecheko tishkav, vatihilo kibat. And the lamb ultimately was like a daughter to him. Vayavo halach l'isha ashir, vayachmo lakachat mitzono umibkaru. But then a traveler came upon the rich man, and instead of taking one of his flock to give to this visitor, la'asov lo'orea chabalo, vayikachet kifsat ha'ish harosh, vayaseha li'ish haba elav. And instead of taking of his own, for he had many, he spared his own, and he took the poor man's lamb, and slaughtered it, and dressed it for the guests that came to him. And without further ado, without Matan even continuing in the Mashal, David already understands that's enough. He can't tolerate it. Vayichar af David ba'ish. And David's anger is going to be aroused against this man in the Mashal. It's albeit a story. Natan did not identify the people. He basically came to David and he says, I have a story to tell you. What do you think about the story? And David's anger is going to be aroused. Vayomer al Natan chai Hashem. Natan says, in the name of Hashem, this person should be put to death. In addition to the biblical law, which is if someone takes someone else's lamb, they have to pay four times that amount. the Al Asher Lo Chamal. Notice how David himself incorporates the same words of the Mashal. The wealthy man is the guilty one. He was the one, Vayachmol Al Tzono, who had compassion for his own flock, and therefore, he, in a very grieving manner, he took someone else's flock, Asher Lo Chamal, and didn't have compassion, not necessarily on the poor man's lamb, he didn't have compassion on the poor man himself. To which Natan responds to David, now you understand, Ata Ha'ish, you are the man. And right away, we're supposed to appreciate this is Natan divulging to David, this was a mashal. And it's not as if David appreciated every aspect of the mashal yet. When he says, Chalila, when he says, this person should be put to death, Chai Hashem ki b'mavet ha'ish ha'osezot. Because Natan apparently still has to identify one aspect to David. Ata ha'ish. You understood one aspect of the mashal, but now I want you to apply it to your personal life, to your persona. You are the man. You now have to internalize that mashal. And this already tells us that David's mind has to be turning and churning right now, trying to understand how he is supposed to apply the mashal to his own life. What greater level of education is this than having the subject, as we've discussed by various psychologists, and by Parshanim, by Chazal, appreciating what a mashal is, the handles to the hot water, the handles to a basket of fruit, to truly appreciate the beauty, and at times, the lesson, albeit but very dangerous and stark, one has to understand how this applies to oneself, and notice then how creative Natan is. We're going to see how even though we may have learned this mashal various times, it's not as simple as what meets the eye. David was quick to respond, but we're going to see right now that there are various levels of understanding the mashal and the nimshal. On the most basic level, and that the mashal resonates with us, we hear of the wealthy man. The wealthy man apparently is whom? He who has everything. He who has a numerous flock and has been given various brachot of Hashem. Well, Natan explains, on a most basic level, Pasuk Zayin, Ata Ha'ish, Ko Amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Anochi Mishachticha L'melech Al Yisrael, V'anochi Hitzalticha Miyad Sha'ul. David, I gave you everything that you could have ever asked for, and I saved you from Sha'ul. You had everything. V'etznalecha Beit Adonecha, V'etnishe Adonecha B'cheikecha. And you had all the women that you could ask for. Ve'etzna lecha et Beit Yisrael v'Yehuda. And I also gave you malchut. Ve'ma'at v'osifo lecha chahina v'chahina. And you name it. You have an army. You have wonderful generals. You have a beautiful palace. You have wonderful children. Madua bazite tvar Hashem nasol tara ve'inai et uri achiti kita v'cheriv. So why did you do this? Why did you abuse, apparently, the poor man? Now, based on this, who's the poor man? Is Uriah. You took advantage of Uriah. Ve'disho lakachta lecha li'isha. By taking his wife and having her in your chayk, taking her to your bosom. Apparently, then, Bathsheba is whom in the mashal? She's the lamb. But at the same time, the lamb was slaughtered. So who's also the lamb? The lamb is also Uriah. So here we find the beauty of a mashal. The mashal is not supposed to be a clear-cut parallel. The mashal is not an SAT analogy, but rather, the mashal allows for so many different levels of interpretation. The lamb can be Bathsheba, who is in his chayk, but the lamb is also slaughtered as Uriah. Va'oto harakta b'cherev b'nei amon. But at the same time, we also see that Nishe Adonecha b'cheikecha. Who else did David have that he took b'cheiko? He also had other wives. So maybe they're also abused through the actions of David, through him taking Bathsheba. Vata lo tasur cherev b'beitecha adolam. And part of the mashal then is for David to conclude it. He explains, based on what David had said, David says, Chai Hashem ki ben mavet ha'ish ha'osezot. The person who perpetrated this crime should die. And now Natan responds, yes, that's what I wanted you to say, because what's the nimshal? The nimshal is that you deserve to die. Lo tasor cheret mebitacha adolam. The sword is now going to strike you. Ekev ki bizitani, batikachas eshet uriah hachiti, liot lacha liisha. For the way that you mocked Uriah, it's really about your abuse of the other, of Uriah, your faithful warrior, your servant. Kama Hashem, hinni mekim alacha ra'am mebitacha, velakachta et nashecha le'inacha. And now your own wives are going to be taken before your very eyes. And this we know is an allusion to Avshalom, who is going to abuse the concubines of David. V'natati l'reyacha v'shacha v'nashacha le'enei ha'shemesh hazot. Pasuk yubet, ki ata asita baseter. What you did in private, and to a certain degree, what Natan is telling David, what you understood on your own through this mashal, what seemed to be an independent story, really is meant to apply to you directly. This is the beauty of a mashal, says the Navi. I particularly employed this genre in order to show you that it could be universal, that this is a story of a wealthy man and a poor man. But by you internalizing the message on your own, you are sharing what the message in fact is. And that is that you are guilty and you recognize it on your own. And here's the conclusion. Vayomer David al Natan, chatati l'Hashem. David internalizes that message in such a way that Natan was successful in eliciting the response from him. And we know that Chazal speak here of the difference between David and Shaul, for they both sinned. And yet David is able to appreciate on his own what his sin was. So as opposed to Shmuel, who directly approaches and reproaches Shaul after Shaul has not killed the king of Amalek and has allowed the people to take from the spoils of war, Shmuel asks him directly, Madua lo shamata b'kol Hashem? Why have you not obeyed Hashem? And Shaul then automatically denies and says, what do you mean? I did listen to Hashem. Natan perhaps learns from that direct method of rebuke that sometimes the mashal is much more effective. That if we enable the subject to listen in an objective manner and thereby attempt to understand the parallel situation and be able on his own to extrapolate the message to his own life, this is what elicits the response of chatati, of one recognizing the resonance of the story in one's own life. But if we look carefully at this mashal, this is a wonderful example of how sometimes when the ideas resonate, and on one hand we hear the consonance in the story, we're also meant to hear the dissonance in the story. For example, in the mashal, Natan said that the other man was poor. We don't know that Uriah is poor. As a matter of fact, he lives in Ir David. For all we know, he's a very wealthy man. Chazal tell us that Bathsheba was Achitophel's daughter. I can imagine then that Uriah was probably a distinguished member. And the dissonance itself is supposed to disturb us somewhat. It's supposed to catch us off guard. It's supposed to tell us that as obvious as the parallel seems to be with David's own scenario, it's really not so clear. Another dissonance that we find in the case of Uriah, and we don't hear about his devotion to his little lamb, to Bathsheba, and yet Natan elaborates on how the poor man, took care and fed and gave drink and even rested with his lamb. And lastly, in the mashal, the lamb is taken as part of a meal, whereas David took Bathsheba prior to any meal and prior to any seudah, alluding perhaps even more to his cover-up. So on one hand, the connection between the mashal, the parable, and the incident described in the chapter seems to be clear. The rich man is David, the poor man is Uriah, but the lamb can be Bathsheba or also Uriah. As for the traveler, Chazal explained in Masechet Sukkah, Daf Nun Bet Amud Bet, that the reference to the traveler who comes is the Yetzer Hara, the one who walks parallel to David, who started off with a David Holech Al Hagag, the origin of his sin, that ultimately starts as a guest, but then resides within the home. But the details of the parable that don't have parallels in the story, whether it's that David did not actually slaughter the lamb, but he sent her husband to death, or the traveler in the story that doesn't have such an exact parallel, this is clearly, as the Mitzvot Zion tells us, to teach us that although there is a connection, a basic connection, the beauty of a mashal is to add various ideas that don't have a connection to the story involving David, so that David should not think that it's obvious that it's applying to his life and refrain thereby from issuing a ruling against himself. Or as the Rambam tells us in Moreh Nevuchim, don't be led astray by the various mishalim of nevuah, because if you're looking for an exact parallel between every aspect of the mashal and the nimshal, then you're going to delude yourself into thinking that there are exacting details. And even more so, you're going to get lost with the trees and you won't be able to see the forest. And that's the beauty of the device of mashal. That's the beauty of storytelling, of trying throughout the classroom setting, but certainly as we speak to our children, to infuse them with stories, whether they're the stories of Gedolim, whether we read them from Kolasu Chachamenu or from modern works, and of storytelling, whether we use even ancient folk tales in order to enable them to think and thereby apply the lessons to their own lives. But the question still remains, why did Natan need this mashal? It stands to reason that there is a value in David issuing a verdict about himself, coming to a true sense of what we know as hakarat hachet and vidui. For after issuing a harsh verdict about the rich man, it would be difficult for David then to argue in his own favor after it became clear that the parable is referring to David himself. Nevertheless, there's room to ask, surely Natan is about to level an unequivocal term, severe accusations regarding the killing of Uriah and taking of Bathsheba. Wouldn't these accusations not suffice? Would it not be enough for Natan, like Shmuel, to accost David directly? Does not the parable of this Kivsat Harash, of the poor man's lamb, reduce the severity of David's actions and make it seem as if this is a universal story? For this we have to understand a mashal particularly in the setting of a judicial parable. And this is a device that we find not only in this story of David, but we find other times where a Navi approaches particularly a king to judge, to assess a situation in the context of mishpat, to determine what justice is. Anyone know any other place in Tanakh where a Navi will employ a mashal in order to extrapolate, in order to try to elicit some response from none other than a king? Mishpat Shlomo, right, is a classic example, beautiful, of a mashal. And yet it's unclear whether that's merely a mashal or an actual story that's presented to Shlomo. So perhaps there are two more obvious cases. One of Achashverosh did it in the context of Haman, right? That really, that was all a fabricated tale that Esther is trying to plant in Achashverosh's mind. Beautiful. But particularly in Nevi'im, we find two more similar mishalim. One is also addressed to David, and that is through Yoav sending the famous Isha Hatko'it, the woman from Tekoa, who is sent to David in particular in order to issue a judgment. And she comes to the king as opposed to a judge in order to say, I don't want you to think of this as merely a regular judicial case of right and wrong. I want you as the king to understand the particular context of the events and try to determine what is the correct nimshal, what is the legal discussion, and thereby the ruling that should be issued by you. So if you remember, the Isha Hatko'it is sent by Yoav to David in order to encourage him to re-invite Avshalom. So she turns to David and she says, I had two children, and one son murdered the other. And by the rules of the Torah, what should happen now is that my family relatives should kill my other son. But if my other son is killed, then I'll be left with no one. What should be done? Should that my second child also be killed? But if so, then neither myself nor my husband will have a name or remainder on the face of the earth. After succeeding in extracting from David a promise that the second son would not be harmed, the woman of Tekoa then explains to David that the reference is to David himself. Just as he promised not to cause harm to the son who had killed his brother, so he must practice regarding himself to restore Avshalom and not to execute him, despite Avshalom's murder of Amnon. The third judicial parable that we find in Navi is found in Sefer Malachim, Perek Chaf, in Malachim Aleph, in the story of Achav and Ben-Hadad. Achav should have understood that as Hashem granted him a miraculous victory against Aram, he should have killed the king of Aram. And yet, not only does he keep him alive, but he also establishes an alliance with him, only to have a Navi appearing in front of him, disguising himself with a headband over his eyes. And as the king passed by, this man, the prophet, cries out to the king. He says, I was a soldier in war in the midst of battle. And a man turned aside and he brought a prisoner of war to me. And he said, keep this man, watch over this prisoner. For if you let him go, then your life should be instead of his life. And in addition to the life, or else you shall pay a talent of silver. So as I was so busy, explains the prophet, the soldier, he says, this man was gone. I did not watch over the prisoner of war. And Achav responds and he says, so your judgment should in fact be that you should be killed or you should pay the talents of money that you took responsibility for. The Navi then explains that this was merely just a parable. As he took the headband away from his eyes, Achav discerned that he was one of the Nevi'im, and he said to him, this is the message of Hashem. Because you had let the prisoner of war, you let Ben-Hadad out of your sight, he was meant to be destroyed, to be killed, therefore your life should be in place of his life, and your people for his people, and we know that Achav ultimately is going to die in war against Aram. What is the meaning then of a judicial parable, of a Navi approaching a king, and employing this device? The answer lies in the common denominator in all three of these parables. In each of the three cases, the turning to the king tells us that as opposed to an ordinary judge, of which there seemingly is a very clear judgment, according to the special circumstances, the king has the authority to issue exceptional rulings based on a broader perspective. The parable creates a case-specific situation, and it motivates the listener to think beyond just the rule, considering the welfare of the nation, and certainly himself. So too in the parable of the Kivsat HaRash, the expectation is not just for what the Torah says, pay fourfold for the lamb, but rather more severe than the Torah's verdict owing to the aggravating circumstances. Instead of taking from his own flock, the rich man took the poor man's only lamb. David fulfills this expectation as Natan is trying to ensure and issues the most severe ruling. The man that has done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold. What Radak explains as literally double the amount, or Rashi, literally the death penalty. As Chazal explained, David will not only suffer the death of Bathsheba's oldest child, but also the rape of Tamar, the death of Amnon, and ultimately the death of Avshalom. And the other two cases as well, the Ishat Koit, and in the case of Achav, we find the same exact rulings of being able to appreciate that the king has to understand that this specific mashal applies to him. The mashal is, of course, used to clarify some aspects of real-life situation. The main message that Natan wishes to convey to David through the mashal is not merely that he's guilty of sending someone to his death and taking his wife. Rather, we're dealing here with particularly aggravating circumstances. David has received so much from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. David has received women and children, and nevertheless, he wasn't content with what he had, but he had to take Bathsheba, Uriah HaKitit's only wife. For this reason, the punishment has to be more severe, and David has to be the one to recognize that and issue the ruling in this case. However, if we look at the mashal, we discuss in our introduction that the mashal has various levels of meaning, and it is meant to be creative. So David apparently understands, I'm that man, I'm the wealthy man, I'm the man, Chatati, who took the poor man's lamb. And yet, other parshanim and literary scholars look at this and say, what Natan was trying to tell David is, look at the wealthy man who had a lamb that he cared at the poor man who had a lamb that he cared for, and the wealthy man abused that. Some parshanim explain that Natan is really alluding to Shaul, who took David and then abused his power and attempted to kill David, even though David didn't deserve it. That David was actually the lamb, to which David is then accosted, David, you've become Shaul. You've allowed power to corrupt you. And David recognizes, Hatati, I who was the victim, also became the perpetrator. In conclusion, there is room to consider one other question. How did David, a very bright man, not understand that the mashal was about him? Even though we stated above that the stories, that there really are differences, but the basic matter should be very clear. Especially because the story is told by a Navi, as opposed to other parables, even those of Shlomo. And therefore, it should have appeared even more credible. Is it so difficult to understand that Natan was alluding to David HaMelech himself? This seems to indicate the extent to which David has repressed his sin prior to Natan's arrival. It may be presumed that David justified his actions to himself in various ways, especially the killing of Uriah. When the episode came to a close, he gave it no further thought, and he removed it from his mind. This deep repression testifies that, in fact, David understood the severity of his sin, and it stands to reason that David was worthy of Hashem helping him out, which did not allow him to run away from his sin, as he says in Tehillim, V'chatati negdi tamid. Going back then to the princess and the pea, the mashal is used to teach us the sensitivity, in this case, of nobility. The nobility should be sensitive. David senses the pea right away, even when it's hidden. The mashal is the Navi's way to elicit that sensitivity, to enable the subject to recognize, to contemplate ideas on one's own, to think through the images, the resonance, the consonance, and the dissonance. As parents, as educators, we have to employ on a daily basis creative means, not merely to captivate and to illustrate, but to enable our children to think independently, to listen, to process, to incorporate the lessons that are unique to them, to their daily activities, to their sensitivities. Let's think out of the box, out of the ordinary, and apply the messages to their personal lives. Sometimes it means quoting a story of Chazal, sometimes it means fabricating our own tales. Sometimes it means intertwining the bedtime stories that our own parents taught us with personal experiences and transforming them into fascinating lessons that can be learned. The power of mashal transforms the listener, the student, into his or her own teacher, to one who can say, like David, Chatati l'Hashem on one's own. These are the lessons that will stay with him forever, because these are the lessons that we allow them to teach themselves.